I have a little confession I need to make, just get this off my chest right here. About 8 days ago, I told a fib. It was on Twitter, so it doesn't really count, but here's the deal. My wife said, you want to go to a movie? Of course, I do. And as a doting husband, I said, whatever, honey, whatever movie you want to go to. She chose Hope Springs. For those who don't know what Hope Springs is, you could probably tell just by the sudden surge of estrogen in the room that it is a chick flick. And on my way in, I got caught going in by one of you. And I was terribly afraid that my man card would be depleted. So as soon as I got in, I tweeted this. Barbara and I are at Hope Springs. I don't know anything about the movie, but she told me it was like just like The Bourne Legacy. I'm so excited. When we look at our passage tonight, we're looking at actually two chapters, chapter 8 and chapter 9. Chapter 8 in the Bible is the book of Judges, and chapter 9 is the book of Ruth. Ruth is kind of like Hope Springs. Joshua, or Judges, is kind of like, well, that would be Bourne Legacy. The whole story of Ruth is a girl meets boy, fall in love, he dies, she goes back to a foreign country with her mother-in-law, falls in love with a rich guy, they get married, have the baby, or eventually that's the line of Christ, and they live happily ever after. Okay, so that's the chick flick thing. The guys, every man in here, if you haven't quite been reading the story and think, I need to get into that, this is the week that you need to read it. I'm talking about everything a guy likes is in here. That goes also for junior high boys. It's got violence and swords and bloodshed and sex and honor and valor. I mean, the book of Judges is like, it's a man's book. Why in the world did God have these two books, like a girly girl novel, next to a man's book? They actually do go together. And if you turn to chapter 9, page 121, you'll see in the very first sentence, they are connected. In the days when the judges ruled, this chick flick, like romance novel, by the way, I wonder if Wilson had me preach this just because he wouldn't have to. Nonetheless, all of that took place right in the midst of what was going on with the judges. So the chaos created by men is this story about a woman falling in love. And it is chaotic by any account. There are 13 judges in the Bible. The story lifts three of them to highlight. You want to hear one of them? I can't tell you all of them, but one of them is Deborah. It's a woman. Now, don't think of like Julia Childs. Think rather like Angelina Jolie. This is the kind of woman you get to brag to your buddies about. She is just bad. And she goes up to this general up north, Barak, and says, Barak, get off your backside, get into the battle. You got to protect your own people up here, son. And he goes, I don't know if I can do that. If you go with me, I'll go. If you don't go with me, a no go. And she said, I'll go with you. But because you're a coward, the glory of the battle is going to go to a woman. And everybody reading it thinks, oh, Deborah's going to get the glory into the story. No, actually, it's not her. Fast forward. Barak beats up on Sisera. That's the opposing general, which, if you ask me, that's a very unfortunate name for a military man. I am Sisera. So he gets whooped, and his whole army is decimated. He flees north to his king. And on the way, he stops at the house of Heber, an ally. Now, Heber's not home, but his wife is. Her name is Jael. And she crosses two lines that any good woman ought never to cross. First, she said, oh, yeah, come into my tent. No man ought to be going to a woman's tent. But she goes, no, come in here, hide. I'll keep you safe. And then, if that's not bad enough, she crosses another line. She says, lay down in my bed. I'll keep you safe, honey. And he goes, I'm so thirsty. Could you get me a drink? He just wanted water. She gave him milk. Now, I don't know if you want to read between the lines of her crossing two lines, but that's far enough, isn't it? And as he's sleeping, sounds like another chick flick, She takes a tent peg, and it hovers precariously over his temple. And while he's sawing logs, she picks up a hammer, and with one sweeping movement, boom, nailed him. Barak comes breathless. Have you seen my enemy? And she says, Jael, why, yes, I have. Where is he? In there. Opens up the tent. Holy shnikes, there he is in a pool of blood, nailed to the floor. Now, I don't know if Heber agreed with her decision or not. I guarantee you he didn't argue with the woman. The Bible doesn't say this, but for the next couple of years, you know, every time they got in an argument, she said, honey, you look a little tired. Why don't you go lay down for a nap? End of that story. Hey, we need to get to Ruth, because that's really what I want to drill down on. But do you want to hear just one more of Judges? Like I said, if you haven't read this stuff, you just got to read this book of Judges. Okay, one more. It's Gideon. Gideon was a guy, he's just a farmer from the lowest tribe, the lowest clan, and God called him to do this battle against the Midianites. They were like locusts all over a field. Midianites everywhere. All he can muster is 32,000 soldiers. That's all he's got to beat this horde. It's not enough. But God comes and says, Gideon, you got too many soldiers. What are you talking about, too many soldiers? God, I've got 32,000. They got hordes. He goes, thin them out. You tell everybody, if you're scared, just go home. 22,000 left. He got 10,000 men to fight these barbaric hordes of Midianites, and God, he goes to God, you happy now? And God says, well, actually, no, I'm not. You've got too many men. What are you talking about, too many men? You take them down to the river, have them drink. Keep only the guys that kneel down and lap like a dog. That's the guys I want. And Gideon, he's just crossing his fingers. How many are you going to, you know how many? 300. 300 against this innumerable army. And God says, that's good. Because now the glory doesn't go to Gideon, it goes to God. Get it? God says, here's the strategy. Give every soldier a trumpet. Give every soldier a torch. Give every soldier a pitcher and a sword. But the sword's just for show. You won't really need that. Surround the Midianites at night and on cue. You take the pot and you slam it down and break it. That'll jolt them awake. Raise up your torches to give light and then blow the trumpet. That'll scare them. And it did. The Midianites were multilingual. And so when they are jolted awake and they hear the trumpet, they think that there's a company for every trumpet. They didn't know it just, that was the greatest bluff ever. Like in Vegas, that would just be ridiculous. The odds are against them. But the Midianites, because each one starts speaking in their own language, they thought the Israelites had invaded the camp, and they just start swinging their swords willy-nilly, hacking each other down. And the Israelites are just kind of leaning on their swords going, God, that was cool, man. They just went in to clean up the mess. That was the story of Gideon. Incredible faith. So we need to get to Ruth. Okay, one more story. Samson, have you heard of him? Big, strong guy. Terrible track record with women. And you'll read all the women that preceded Delilah, but she, hands down, has to be the worst. Because, like, she's his lover, and she's from a different religion. And God said, don't intermarry with people of other religions. It'll mess you up. Boy, was God right on that one. She comes to Samson, and the people around her are saying, Delilah, find out his secret so we can kill him. We want to kill your lover. And she goes, okay. You women can be tough. She goes into Samson's, honey, how'd you get to be so strong, you big hunk of beef, you? And he goes, well, babe, you know, my secret is that if you tied me up with brand new bowstrings, get 7 of them, brand new, I'd be as weak as any other man. She lulls him to sleep. She ties him up with these strings. And she says, Samson, the Philistines are upon you. He jumps up, pops the strings, and just beats the bejeebers out of her relatives. There was a fight afterwards. Now, you would think Samson is saying to Delilah, how dare you try to kill me? No, it's her blaming him. You made fun of me. Ladies, I do not know how you do this. It's always our fault. You're genius. You made fun of me. You're laughing at me now. Tell me your strength, or I'm not going to. And so Samson said, well, honey, the secret of my strength is you need new ropes that have never been used before. Tie me up with new ropes, and I'll be as weak as any other man. She lulls him to sleep, ties him with ropes, and yells, the Philistines are upon you. He pops up, snaps him like strings, beats up everybody, and now she's really mad. You made fun of me twice. How dare you do that to me? And I'm thinking, lady, talk about a black widow. And he goes, okay, I'll tell you. Seriously, it's my hair. If you were to weave my hair into a loom, I could never get out of it. My seven great locks of hair. So she lulls him to sleep. She weaves his hair into a womb. Fast asleep. And then she says, the Philistines are upon you. He pops up, yanks his head, and just shakes the loom loose and wreaks havoc on his enemies. And now she's mad. You got to read this. If this was not in the Bible, I would write it in because it needs to be. Page 117. Third paragraph from the bottom. You're not going to believe this. This is from God. Then she said to him, how can you say I love you when you won't confide in me? Dude, guys, just be honest. We're morons. This is the third time now you've made a fool of me and haven't told me the secret of your great strength. Now this next sentence, dude, seriously, you gotta pay attention. With such nagging, she prodded him day after day until he was sick to death of it. That's not a euphemism. He would rather die than hear her nagging. He tells her the truth about his hair. She goes to sleep. She shaves it off. And when he wakes up, he can't fight and defend himself. They grab him, bind him, gouge out his eyes, and put him in prison until the day he died. He would only get out one more time. Ah, no spoilers here. You got to read it yourself. Those are the stories that precede Ruth, that actually surround her life. But I want you to see something. In the days of the judges, 13 total, 3 in the story, there was a cycle that just kept going around and around and around. You see it in your program, where Israel would sin. They forgot the God of their ancestors, and they would do just whatever they wanted to do. And then God would punish them by giving them over to the enemies that they wanted to be friends with. When you play with the world, God will give you over to the world, and you think God's tough to follow. The world is a nasty taskmaster. And so they fell into submission, and they had to obey their enemies. And in that submission, they felt bad, and they were sorrowful. So the sorrow followed submission, and they cried out to God, God, help me, please. And God did, and that's salvation. And around we go again. Once they're saved, they forgot their God. Sin, submission, sorrow, salvation. Sin, submission, sorrow, salvation. And around it goes. Where it stops, nobody knows. But here's where it started. If you turn to the beginning of chapter 8, page 103, these are the first words in the book of Judges. The people served the Lord throughout the lifetime of Joshua, and the elders who outlived him and who had seen all the great things the Lord had done for Israel. For the eyewitnesses of God's glory, they lived faithful to God, but once they died, their children forgot about the greatness of God and began serving the gods all around them. You know how the book of Judges ends? It's this terrifying statement. It's printed in your program. Everyone did what was right in his own eyes because there was no king in Israel. It's not just the last verse of the book. 3 times earlier, it said the exact same thing. Chapter 19, verse 1, chapter 18, verse 1, chapter 17, verse 6. There was no king in Israel. Everyone did what was right in his own eyes. Chaos ensues. Some of you know all too well the chaos of living life on your own without serving God. In the midst of that chaos, the book of Ruth begins. In the days when the judges ruled, there was a famine in the land. Well, of course there was. When you do what you want to do, of course there will be famine in the land. So a man from Bethlehem in Judah, together with his wife and two sons, went to live for a while in the country of Moab. The guy's name is given in the next sentence, Elimelech. Oddly, Elimelech means, my God is king. But he was not. The guy didn't live up to his name. Instead of trusting in the one living God, he goes to Moab and trusts in their food supply. He takes his wife, Naomi, with him, and his two sons, they're named there too, Mahlon and Chilion. And as the story unfolds, the boys fall in love. They marry a couple of fine little Moabite girls that don't know about the God of Israel. Bad investment if you're a dad. By the end of the first two paragraphs of chapter 9, I feel like I'm reading a Nicholas Sparks novel. Dad dies. Poor Naomi. Then Mahlon dies and Chilion dies. Now you got three widow women watching out for one another, and there's all kinds of weeping and tears, and the Kleenex box comes out. But turn the page. Eventually, the famine subsides, and Naomi says to the girls, go home. Orpah, one of the girls, kissed her goodbye and left. But look halfway down the page. It says, Ruth clung to her. Same word as used in Genesis. A man will leave his father and his mother and cling to his wife. She is devoted. A couple of paragraphs down, Ruth replied, don't urge me to leave you and turn back from you. Where you go, I will go. Where you stay, I will stay. Your people will be my people, your God, my God. Show of hands, both campuses, how many of you have heard that verse before? Yeah, look at all the hands. You know why? Because you go to weddings. And at weddings, we read this kind of stuff. Pretty little girl standing there in a white dress, turns over to her husband. Oh, she's convinced this is a, all her life, she's going to obey him. Absolutely. It's the way it always works out. And she says, honey, where you go, I'll go. Your God will be my God. But look in the text. She's not saying that to her husband. She's saying it to her mother-in-law. Holy snikes. Can you imagine? How many of you ladies would look past your husband and say to mother-in-law, yeah, I'll follow you wherever you want to go, Mom. Yeah, in fact, I'll come live in your house and you can be in charge of the kitchen. Yeah, right. And you think, well, maybe Naomi was just such a lovely person to be around. So chipper. I have no evidence of that. As a matter of fact, if you look down at the bottom of the page, she says, on page 122, next to the last paragraph, don't call me Naomi. Her name Naomi meant something like, she is pleasant, the pleasant one. She says, rather call me Mara. That word means bitter. She says, she's a bitter old woman. And Ruth says, somebody has to look out for her. Somebody needs to care for her, and it's going to be me. And she decides, I am going to forsake my family, my country, my home, to take care of a woman that probably doesn't deserve it. From this story, I want to lift three life lessons. Here's one. Your sacrifice may be your salvation. So often when we make a sacrifice for someone else, we say, you know, I'm so kind, I'm so magnanimous, I'm going to help you. And typically, our service to others is God's way of saving us. Ruth would never have been part of the people of God had she not made this sacrifice. Some of you know that well. You have a child with a disability. And when you learned of the child's disability, all those questions went through your mind. But now, having lived with it for a while, you realize how much God has done for you. Not in spite of this, but because of this. Some of you, your parents are aging, and you think, oh my goodness, all the responsibility when the tables turn. And after a while, you realize it's not in spite of this, it's because of this. My own father-in-law took care of his wife in a nursing home. He went to see her every day, twice a day, for 7 years. The character that was forged in him and then reflected to me, that was a saving grace in my life. Every time I think, God, look at, I'm sacrificing for you. It turns out that my sacrifice is God's favor for my salvation. Well, she goes back to Bethlehem. It's an important town. And it's the barley harvest, late March, early April. And this young girl, Ruth, is able to glean on the edges of the field. A law in Israel, all poor people can pick up the grain from the edge of the field. And this particular field belonged to Boaz. He's a great guy. And he's got plenty of barley for himself, and so he leaves a little bit of extra for the poor. In fact, he heard about Ruth. And because of her reputation, he said to his workers, "Don't you mess with Ruth. You leave her alone. In fact, take a few extra stalks of barley out and drop them so Ruth can get enough to eat." First day, she had gleaned 35 pounds of grain. She got it home, and Naomi was all kind of excited about that. She had to hear the story. But first, this second life lesson: your tragedy may be God's master plan. We read about Boaz, and we realize, wait a minute, he's kinsman to Ruth, or to Naomi. He's going to be able to take care of them. That's part of God's plan. And Bethlehem, oh, little town of Bethlehem. You remember? Birthplace of Jesus, hometown of David. Bethlehem is a spiritually significant place. It's purposeful that God brings Ruth to this place for this time to meet this man. Sometimes you think, God, why are you letting this happen to me? Oh, you just wait. Don't you ever look over your shoulder and realize what I thought was a tragic loss, a car accident, or my parents took me and I moved. Well, that's where I met my husband. That saved me from a worse accident down the road. Most of the tragedies in our life are orchestrated by God. I'm not saying that God causes your pain. I'm saying he uses the tragedies of our life to orchestrate a master plan. Hear me now. God has a plan for you. And if you're patient enough, like Ruth, you will see that God always has a new chapter in your story. And that's where she is. She goes home and tells Naomi about, well, she didn't have to tell her. She got 35 pounds of grain. And Naomi asks, "Where'd you get all that?" "What, a guy named Boaz." And she goes, "Boaz, he's my relative. And he likes you." Boaz has a crush on Ruth. I don't know how you women do this matchmaking thing. You're insane. You just get all excited about putting people together. And here's Naomi's plan. Ruth, Boaz is going to be the threshing at his threshing floor over there tonight. Wait till he has it. He's got a nice big meal. Wait till he eats and he's, you know, full. And then he's going to have a bottle of Mogan David. Wait till he drinks that, because then, well, and then wait till he falls fast asleep and get in bed with him. I mean, you think I'm making it up? Page 125 is there in black and white. These are PG-13 stories now. Careful when you read them to your kids. Page 125, she does it. She is, talk about a proposal. She wants to marry the guy. Would you hop in bed? I guess that's clear enough. He does nothing with it. He says yes to the proposal, but wait to her. And he says, "Look, before the sun comes up, I want you to go back home. And I'll take care of business so that we can be married. But you go back home, Ruth, and I don't want anybody to see your face, so before it gets light, you go ahead and go." What an honorable man. She is pressed by her poverty into extreme measures, but he takes care of protecting her honor. He is what is called throughout the book a guardian redeemer. Now, that's kind of a technical term. There were some legalities in Jewish families. Basically, if you wanted to inherit a widow's property, you had to marry her. And he is a kinsman, so he can marry Ruth, but there's another one who is a closer, what the story is calling a guardian redeemer. You see it the first time on page 124, two-thirds of the way down. The guardian redeemer could receive the property of the deceased, but he had to marry the widow and have children through her. The guy who was closest, he went to court the next day, and Boaz asked him, "Are you going to do this?" And he goes, "Yeah, I want the property." He goes, "No, but you have to take the woman too." Nobody wanted a Moabite. And he goes, "I'll take the Moabite. I will do the honorable thing by her and get the property and plant more crops." This concept of a guardian redeemer, it presses forward clear to the New Testament, right? A redeemer is one who has the right and the privilege to purchase and pay the price to set things right. It's the right and privilege to pay the price to set things right. You read it once on page 124, three times on page 125, four times on page 126. The last time you read it, page 127. It's no longer talking about Boaz as the guardian redeemer. You know who he's talking about? Obed. Obed was the baby of Ruth and this guy named Boaz. And Obed had a baby. His name was Jesse. And Jesse had a son. His name? David. Yeah. King David. That's the one. Who became the forerunner of the Christ. See, here's the third lesson. Your happy ending is usually not for you. Happy endings are seldom for you. They're usually for someone else down the line. Oh yeah, she had a happy ending and they lived happily ever after, but the story doesn't end there. It points forward. In the story of God, in the upper level, God says, I'm going to bring a redeemer, someone who is qualified and capable to pay the price to set things right. Here's what I noticed. As you set these two stories together, most of us want to find ourselves in the book of Judges, right? We want to be a hero who saves the day. We swing a sword. We triumph. We take a hill. Do you know that no individual in the book of Judges really saved Israel? It was a mess. By the end, it was a chaos. You know what saved Israel? Jesus Christ, that came through the long and faithful, patient service of a Ruth. Sometimes we think, if I could just be great for God in a moment. God doesn't need you to be great in a moment. He needs you to be good for a lifetime. He needs you to be a father with an ADD son, that you work hard all day long and you come home exhausted and you just want to have a meal around your table, but after the dishes are cleaned, you spend another 2 hours to teach your son math. That's a hero. It's the couple that bring in their elderly parents to live with them because you don't want them to be alone in a care facility. That's not possible for everybody, but where it is, man, is that noble. It's a wife that said when she was a pretty young thing and too dumb to really know what it meant, in sickness and in health. And now you know exactly what it means, and you keep a promise that you made to God. It's about a worker who works for a boss for a decade, and day after day, in spite of his pagan infidelity, you serve him well, and you are Christ to him. See, Jesus doesn't just redeem humanity. Typically, Jesus redeems humanity through us. So the question I want to leave you with, the takeaway for you, is there's one more blank for you to fill out. I want you to put there a name or an address. A person whose life is really living in the Judges. It's chaos. And you don't even like going over there because you know that they just make you crazy. Yeah, Ruth knew about that. Her mother-in-law told everyone to call her bitter. And maybe your person is bitter, and maybe they're angry. Maybe there are a lot of things. But if they're lost, would you be faithful? When no one else is looking, would you be faithful so that the Redeemer could come into their life? Holy Father, this is hard work. This isn't a take-the-hill moment where everybody watches and you get your name put in the book of Judges. This is a decade where we serve in anonymity a person that is thankless and hopeless and perhaps even mean. But so many of us, that would be our story were it not for the grace of someone who is Jesus to us before Jesus could meet us. It is in Jesus' name that we pray. Amen.